Today's program was brought to you by Bordeaux Wines. Red, white, rosé, there's a reasonably priced wine for everyone and for every occasion. For more information, visit bordeaux.com/US. Today's program is brought to you by Campari. For more information, visit campari.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I am your host, Joe Campanelli, and I am really excited about today's show. Before we get started, I want to let you guys know there are many ways to listen to In the Drink. You can listen to it on heritageradionetwork.org. You can listen to it on Stitcher, which is pretty wonderful place to listen to podcasts, iTunes, or as I do, I just use the iTunes app on my phone. And really, we are anywhere better or not so good podcasts are being played. You can find In the Drink. So please do sign up and subscribe to In the Drink on any way that you like to listen to podcasts. All right. So I'm excited about today's show. We actually have two guests with us today in the studio here to celebrate the first ever Week of Orange Wine. The creator of the Week of Orange Wine, Stetson Robbins from Blue Danube Wine, and then also Dorley Muir from the Muir van der Neerpoort Winery in Carnuntum, Austria. These are some of the most beautiful, elegant wines coming out of Austria. In her other life, she also has a PR company that represents some of the greatest wines in the world, such as wines of Austria and wines of Portugal. And she makes a wine that is, I guess, considered to be maybe an orange wine because it's a white wine with extended skin maceration. But we can debate what is an orange wine and all of that here on today's show. And we can also find out really important topics of discussion, such as, is it Blaufränkisch or Blaufränkisch? All to come today. But welcome to the show, everyone.
Hi.
Hi, thank you, Joe.
Stetson, tell us about your idea of Week of Orange Wine. It's something that you have been talking to me about for quite some time. Like, Joe, let's do Week of Orange Wine. Let's make it happen. And I'm always like, I love the idea, but I don't have the energy to do it. But you've made it happen.
Well, I certainly have not done it alone. And your interest in it originally certainly helped to encourage bringing it up to other buyers in shops and restaurants. Tara Hammond at Amphora, I have to say, was really one of the big motors for it. She kind of demanded that we do it, and I'm glad, because the more that I've talked to buyers and sommeliers about it, everybody has their own take on orange wine as a category, has different ideas about how to work with it, and is increasingly adopting it into their wine programs, which I think is great, because diversity in wine is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, and now you hear the word orange wine, and how would you describe orange wine? It's obviously, it's not a flavor, and arguably with Dorley, with your wines, it's not even the color of the wine, but maybe the method. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I don't think, although we are focusing on orange wine as a category for WOW Week of Orange Wine, it's technically not. It's just a vinification technique that is commonly applied to red grapes, but instead applied to whites. And just because it's we call it orange wine doesn't mean that it's necessarily orange in color, only that the white grapes were handled like red grapes. And Dorley's been introducing hers as the orange green, the green orange wine.
The green orange wine, yes.
And what brought this interest? Why did you start making Grüner Veltliner in this style? It seems that people think of Grüner Veltliner as being such a fresh, clean, crisp, refreshing wine, and arguably that takes some of that away from it, and it's a different idea for Grüner Veltliner.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a very new idea to make an orange Grüner Veltliner, but it's the very, very old style. Because this, you know, that you harvest the grapes and you press them immediately and ferment them without the skins is relatively new. The old way of winemaking was you pick the grapes, you crush them, and later on, like one day, 2 days later, you press them. Why? Because all the aromas, all the history, all the story of a vineyard, of an origin of a grape, is in the skins. It's not in the juice, it's in the skins. So if you press them immediately and you throw away the skins, you throw away the story of the wine. Mm-hmm. So in the old days, it was completely normal that you would leave the wine on the skins for some time, 1-2 days, whatever, and press them only then. And when we started to make white wine on the Spitzerberg, this is what we did from the first day on. At that time, the notion of orange wine didn't exist. We just made the wine the old style, and only some years later, orange wine popped up in our, you know, vocabulary of winemakers. So we did it before that, and we didn't know that we do orange wine. It was just the old style.
Similar to the way the idea of organic wine didn't exist at some time, because there weren't
the
chemicals. It was just the normal thing.
Yeah, it's just a return to what is normal, maybe.
Can you give us a little history lesson to when did the style go from doing a couple of days on the skin to the crisp, clean, fresh pressed style that we know today?
Yeah, so it's of course it was not just, you know, one cut and then everything has changed, but it was an evolution on decades maybe, because this happened when we introduced technology into winemaking, more and more technology and more control. We wanted to have control on everything, not just in winemaking, in everything in life. We wanted to have control on everything. So we introduced stainless steel tanks. We introduced temperature control. We introduced selected yeasts, because there was the idea how the wine should taste, and then we made everything that the result is what we have imagined before in our heads. While the old-fashioned winemaking and the nowadays very modern and hip winemaking is you pick and you let the wine more or less become what it is without having too much control on it. And so this is a change that happened probably, you know, the step towards technology happened in the 80s, more or less. And now the step back again is an evolution for the last 10 years, maybe. So it's like just going right, left, right, left, right, left.
Now, I know that with your wines, you don't use selected yeast. You use just the ambient yeast. Is it easier to do that if you're actually using the skins as well? Because I imagine most of the skins exist live on the skins as well.
Yeah, they live on the skins. Well, I don't think, I mean, once you press, the ferment is in the juice anyhow. I don't think it makes a big difference. The difference is more a question of what the temperature is. So if you try to ferment very, very cool, then it gets maybe difficult with natural yeasts, because they are very slow. Mm-hmm. While if you inoculate with selected yeast, wow, it goes like that and it's fermented in 2 days, it's finished. But if you work with natural yeasts like we do, it's better that you keep the ambient temperature, and it starts fermenting easily like after 2 days or so, and it takes a longer time. So it's a very slow fermentation. It goes its way. Then we also have small quantities, so we don't have big, you know, tanks with 10,000 liters. So ours are just like 500 or 800, so the temperature doesn't get up very high by itself. So it's a slow process, and it's a very natural process. And I think the most important thing that you have to have is time and confidence.
Yeah. And you have the wine here? Can we taste it?
No.
You don't have it. Okay, no, there's yes. another one. There's some wine in front of us. I'm excited to taste it. And how long does it spend on the skins, the one that you did?
Well, usually we crush a little bit, but with our feet, so mm-hmm. we don't put it in the machine, but we walk on it. So we keep the whole bunches with the stems. And we walk it so to get the juice out of the berries, and then it takes maybe like 2 days until it starts fermenting a little, and then we keep it 2 more days to get the story extracted. So maybe 4 days before we press.
And a question for you, Stetson: how do you know when it's an orange wine, right? Because there are white wines that are maybe spend a few hours on the skins, like some Riesling, just to give it some extra texture. Is it an orange wine when someone has said, just because they said it's an orange wine? Like, at what point do you decide that that's what it is?
I don't know that there's a clear answer to that.
Yeah.
I think it's you have some producers who will macerate a small portion of fruit to produce something like a component that will give texture and density to a wine. But as to what technically an orange wine is, it's difficult to define it, mostly because it's not a category. It's just a vinification technique.
And so your company, Blue Danube, has wines all along the Danube going into Eastern Europe and Central Europe. I imagine that is these old wine styles, which sometimes still existed there that you didn't see in Western Europe so much, is part of what has increased spiked your interest in these wines.
Yes, definitely. In the Republic of Georgia, the skin macerated white wines are held in the highest regard, and that's a different paradigm than we're familiar with mm-hmm. in the West, and a valid one. It doesn't mean that we can, it doesn't mean that you should have, that all white varieties should be skin macerated. But I actually think that the story, it's something that should be done. You don't make an orange wine because you want to make orange wine. You make orange wine because that is an expression of the variety that gets it more of its soul, the character of the location, considers the climate of the place. Dorley, can you tell the story of how you found the Gruner Vineyard? I mean, I think that this is a perfect story of why somebody chooses to macerate.
Mm. So all our vineyards are based on the Spitzerberg, which is a very hot and an extremely dry place with limestone. And it's definitely the contrary of what Grüner Veltliner wants. Grüner Veltliner wants a cool place with a soil that can keep enough water. So it is, I would never think about planting Grüner Veltliner there. But when I started the project, 14 years ago with my then husband, I was always looking for old vines on the Spitze to get old vineyards. And one day I went into a wine bar, the only one that exists in our region, and I was there only once, then it closed. And the guy talked to me and said, "Aren't you the one that is always looking for old vineyards?" And I said, "Yes, that's me." I said, "Look, I have one." And he explained to me what was the location of the vineyard, and that it was 30 years old, and that it has good results. And so, and I said, "Okay, that sounds interesting. So can I rent it?" And he said, "Yeah, why not?" So we agreed on a paper still that evening in the bar that I would rent the vineyard and what I would pay for it and everything. And just before I left the bar, he said, "Oh, wait a moment. Did I tell you that it was Grüner Veltliner?" And I said, "Oh, no." I was sure that it would be Blaufränkisch, which is the grape on the Spitzerberg. So then I had some Grüner Veltliner eventually, which I wasn't so much interested in. And I said, "Okay, but this is a sign. If you get a vineyard of 30 years old vines, you don't dig it out." Mm-hmm. So it's a sign that I have to do something with it. And we started to find out how can we get a best expression of that vineyard into the wine. And as it is a very dry place and a very hot place, you can't wait very long with the harvest. Otherwise, you lose all the acidity. So we need to get texture and structure in the wine without it being alcohol. So we pick early, and then we do that, you know, foot stamping and the extraction via maceration. And what you feel in that wine, that structure that you feel in the wine, is from the tannins. It's not alcohol, because this has 12 alcohol. It's quite light.
And this is the wine that we have in our glass right here.
Mm-hmm.
That's so exciting. And this wine is it's so good. It's so delicious. Yeah, and without...
And not extreme.
It's not extreme. No, but the
it has texture.
I
tend to gravitate towards wines with not low acidity, but I don't like to drink wines with lots and lots of acidity. And I find this so attractive because it has structure, dimension, texture. It's not alcoholic, and it's also not, it's not pointy. It's not like a sharp, searing Gruner, as so oftentimes they can be, especially when they're young.
Mm-hmm. And you can easily drink a lot of it, but also it has a lot to say, which is hard to find wines that, you know, are both, right? And how hard is it to find a vineyard, an older vineyard? It sounds like you're doing some looking in that area.
Yes, the area is not very big, but it's many small slots of vineyards. You know, because in the old times, a farmer's family would always divide the property they have between the children. So, you know, with the generations, the little slots that you get there is like two or three rows of wines.
In like the Napoleonic way
in
Burgundy, where
exactly
you have four kids, each one gets a quarter of it,
exactly.
And then each of them has two kids, and it's an eighth of the original.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the way it happened. Nowadays, I must say, the kids are not interested in getting the vineyards at all. So if they inherited it, they immediately what they do is to take the vines out and sell the soil as it. So I'm there always watching, like, where are the old vines, who are the owners, and where is the risk that the next generation would dig it out, and to be there at the right moment and to avoid that happened. So it's a very interesting thing, because these men that are in their 70s, they go out after breakfast very early in the morning. They do their 2-3 hours handwork in the vineyard, and then they go back very often by bicycle, having lunch, and then they lay down. And the next morning they come again and do their work. So it's really very important to them. And you can't tell those people, look, give me your vineyard, you are too old to do it. You know, it's their heart. So I was thinking about how can I avoid that if one day those people don't want to do or can't do the work anymore, how can I avoid that the next generation just sticks the vineyard out? Mm-hmm. So
you can't approach them because of their pride. You can't say,
no, you can't.
Like, it's clear. Come on, man. Like,
respect.
You don't have that much, you know, time left. This is hard for you. Can you just sell me your vineyard?
No.
Like, they have too much pride, and they wouldn't just.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, you can't see a vineyard just as a place where you grow wine and sell it. It's something, you know, they got from their parents and from their grandparents, mm-hmm. and they have to have been every day of their lives. So you can't. Yeah, no, you can't do that. It's very connected. So I thought that the right place, the only place where they would think about giving the vineyard away is when they are really having like aching bags or whatever. So I've asked the doctor of the village, whether I can put a poster in his waiting room. And he said, yeah, why not? So I've put a poster like, I'm searching vineyards, old vineyards, and if you have one, please call me. And it worked quite well. So I got this year, I got a 60 years old vineyard,
wow,
of Blaufränkisch, and I got a full hectare of four different vineyards of Grüner Veltliner, which was not really what I looked for, but I did the first harvest, and it's really, really great. Which are around 30 years old. So it's really, it's a privilege to get those old vineyards who have a lot of history, and it's fantastic. I'm very, very happy and proud. And so after harvested, I went to see those people and brought them some grapes, and I will bring them the wine when it's ready and say, look, this is what happened with your vineyard, and you can be happy and proud that you gave it to me, because I will honor that. And it's a very emotional thing. A vineyard is a very emotional thing.
Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break and contemplate the 60-year-old Blaufränkisch vineyard after this.
And this one is called Wake Up by EULA. We'll be right back. Bordeaux is one of the most reputable and well-known wine regions in the world. While many are familiar with its legendary first growths, there is so much more to discover. Bordeaux offers a dynamic and diverse range of wines, different styles, different colors, and different price points. Did you know that Bordeaux produces crisp, refreshing whites? Or that many of its outstanding reds can be opened now and don't need years aging? Or that it's really easy to find a great bottle of Bordeaux for under $20? With such a diverse offering, Bordeaux wines can pair with a huge mix of contemporary foods and cuisines. Bordeaux wines, red, white, rosé, there's a wine for everyone. For more information, visit bordeaux.com/US.
When you talk about Campari, one of the first things that comes to mind is the inimitable and ubiquitous Negroni cocktail, a favorite of Heritage Radio networks. Joe Campanelli, host of In the Drink on Heritage Radio, talks about the interesting history of the Negroni cocktail.
The classic Milano Torino, which is better known as the Americano cocktail, which is Campari, good red vermouth. Use good red vermouth like Carpano Antica formula, Contrado, Cocchi Vermouth di Torino, one of those, and soda water. Then later on in its history was transformed into the Negroni, which substituted good gin for the soda water, something a little bit stronger. Count Negroni spent many years traveling the Midwest, the Southwest of the United States, found a penchant for strong drinks, and later went to London where he started to like his gin, brought that all back to his favorite bar in Florence and said, I'll take one of those Americano cocktails, but make it stronger, make mine with gin. And such was birthed the Negroni cocktail. And now it's really popular. I find people are asking for Negronis with agave-based spirits, mezcal or tequila Negronis, especially mezcal, a little more popular. So mezcal Negronis are really delicious.
Experiment with your own Negroni recipe and enjoy it with Campari for a perfect cocktail creation. For more information, visit Campari.com.
Please enjoy responsibly.
All right, we're back with Stetson Robbins, Blue Danube, and Dorley Muir of Muir van der Nieport and Wine and Partners from Austria. Stetson, tell us about some of the places where we can find exciting Week of Orange Wine events for the rest of this week, and who's in town? What are some restaurants and wine bars that are participating?
Absolutely. So this is the first time that we've done it, and it came together rather organically. It is coincidental that Dorley actually produces something that's skin macerated herself. On the heels of Dorley is Becca and Nina Gotsadze from the Republic of Georgia. They'll be presenting it raw. There's actually, I think, going to be quite a few examples of orange wine at raw, so a good place to check out. And we're doing a tasting in Hudson with Fish and Game. Peripheral is the name of the tasting, so we'll be there with Goetze, and there'll be some other orange wines there. Terre du Vert and Dirty Bird, they're pouring a lineup for Thursday. Also on Thursday, consumers can go to Back Label Wine Merchants or Discovery Wines and taste orange wine for free.
Oh, wow.
Which is kind of cool. So there's actually quite a few shops that are pouring instead of, you know, they do tastings every couple days or every week, and so they're featuring orange wine. So you might encounter them many other places too.
You know, I find some orange wine naysayers. What do you say to these people? How do you handle people who are like, I just don't like orange wines. White wines aren't supposed to be made with skin contact. It's only for red wines.
Yeah, some people do have this position, and if they're really hard set to it, you can't convince them. But we macerate red grapes. Why can't we macerate white grapes? If you just follow the logic, there's no reason why. I think, as Dorley pointed out earlier, this was something that was traditional prior to the Industrial Revolution and the advent of modern vinification. So it feels – I like drinking the wines myself. I tend to and it doesn't mean – I think a lot of the naysayers criticize the wines for not being qualitatively consistent. But what category of wine is qualitatively consistent? I mean, if you take Pinot Noir or Rosé – if you take rosé, for instance, as a category, there's more bad rosé than good rosé.
That's a good point.
I think it's ridiculous to expect that, you know, all of the orange wines in a category, which producers are largely experimenting with and learning these techniques, it should be expected that, you know, they're not all going to be good.
That makes complete sense. And although this is such an old way of making wine, for many people, they're just starting to bring back this old tradition. So I'm sure there's still a period of learning. And I find that with a lot of the good producers, each year, their skin macerated whites actually get better and better and maybe less extreme and just prettier.
I think with, you know, Muir van den Nieuwpoort's an interesting example because the wines, and we should taste through the Blaufränkisch, they're so precise and detailed and elegant, I think classic, and the white also has those qualities, macerated or not.
Yeah. That white was great. So I'm going to follow your direction, and let's taste some Muir van den Nieuwpoort Blaufränkisch now. Or Blaufränkisch.
Well, it's Blaufränkisch.
Blaufränkisch. Mind blown.
It's Blaufränkisch, actually.
I'm not going to try that one. I'm not going to try that one. In private, I will practice. And so next time, we'll see. Okay, so we have... what do we have in front of us here?
So yeah, I've got the... two Blaufränkisch in front of you, both grown on the hill of Spitzerberg. But so as I told you, we have very little different slots of vineyards, and we pick them separately, we keep them separately, and before we bottle, we see how they developed. And we separate those barrels that are the finest and the longest and put them under a label called Spitzerberg, and all the others that are very complex but maybe not as long, we call them Samt and Seide, which means velvet and silk. And it always happens that the longest and the finest barrels come from the oldest vineyards. So Spitzerberg happens to be a result of vineyards that are between 45 and 60 years old. And Samt and Seide comes from vineyards that are up to 30 years old. And the name Samt and Seide, I think you find both textures in that wine. You have the silkiness, which is very, very dense, very fine, but very, very dense, which is from the terroir of the Spitzerberg. And then the velvetiness that comes from the little bit younger vines that are rounder and softer. So you have both. I tend to say that the Samt and Seide is like serious pop music. I mean, pop music can be very superficial, but it can be serious and exciting. And I think this is what Samt and Seide is. You can drink it easily, but it tells you a lot. It's very long. And Spitzerberg is just the intellectual wine.
I think that Roberta's is playing some serious pop music in the background right now. I really like how the Samt and Seide is really aromatic, very floral and perfumed. I've never had.
It's interesting that you talk so much about texture because the perfume is really so complex and outgoing.
Yeah, but most of the wine drinkers tend to detect first the perfume and then very often stop there, or just then go on the large, you know, on the volume of the wine. But I tend to look more on the texture, which is very often linked to the terroir, to the soil. You know, if you think about Meursault, for example, it's just texture. It's just texture, and this is what I love. And I really want the wine to be dense and have a good structure and long. And I don't look for fruit, because fruit is easy. You can do it with selected yeast. You can, you can control it very much. This is just a natural expression of the fruit, but because we don't interfere, yeah.
In a way, it embodies some of the best wines have tension.
Yes, exactly.
Things that are opposing each other and giving it an energy. And,
yeah.
And here you have that both in the aromas, but also in the texture. And the older vines, we have the 2011, it's extraordinary. It doesn't taste, obviously there's more earthy flavors, but it doesn't taste like it's an older wine, 3 year older wine. It's so bright and vibrant and beautiful.
Yeah, I think Blaufränkisch is a grape that needs time to develop. The hotter the year, the drier the year, the longer it needs. In the old times, we drank Blaufränkisch like after 10 years. It was normal, like for Nebbiolo, Barolo, etc.
Yeah, really.
And it's only in the times of technology that we started to drink wines young, which I think is a mistake. Or you can do it with other grapes, but not with Blaufränkisch. Take your time and then drink it when they are mature. Otherwise, it's just, yeah, a
yeah,
shame.
Dave Foss from Anfora went to Austria recently, and he came back and he was like, Joe, Blaufränkisch with age. This is like, we need to tell everyone about this. He was
exactly
really big on it.
So this is what I'm going to do. It's my next project is to economical project, let's say, is to keep the wines as long in the cellar as they are, until they really are drinkable.
Oh, wow.
Which is tricky because, I mean, you have to talk to the bank. But I think it's a big shame, and it's frustrating if you do everything right in the vineyard, in the cellar, even with the packaging, and then you serve the wine to a person and the person says, it's sour or whatever, because they don't understand that it's too young. Mm-hmm. And nobody can mature the wines anymore. The restaurants don't do it, the distributors don't do it, and the consumers don't have a wine cellar to do it. So if I want that my baby is showing beautifully when a person opens the bottle, I have to keep it myself until it's perfect.
Wow. And you make such a small amount of wine, right? How many bottles do you produce annually?
I make like 30,000 bottles
30,
a year.
30,000 bottles. So to put, are you going to take, but keep everything back or release some early and then
exactly
keep some
so this
back.
Is I just amazing. Kept the half of 2011 and I release it now only so the 2012 for example is drinkable earlier, so I released the 2012 before the 11 was finished, and so now I do it like that way.
So this we're actually going to have the 14 was kind of, you feel, is an earlier drinking vintage, and so the next it'll probably be in the spring when we switch over to these wines. Right now we're selling the 12 and 13 Sumptum Saida. Next we'll sell 11 and 14. So we'll have two vintages in parallel, same price, the intention being to offer two different expressions of Spitzerberg.
Great. And if you could put your PR hat on for a moment, and here at Heritage we're very interested in things that are made naturally and organically, like your wine certainly fall into it. When studying about wine, we always hear that Austrian wines are some of the cleanest and most organic in the world. Is that true? Is that still the case? Is there really a push for organic viticulture throughout Austria?
Definitely. I think all the leading producers and more of the non-leading producers are converted either to organic, but many of them to biodynamics. And it is, you know, Austria is a country that lives so much from its nature, you know, in tourism and in food and everything. So it is also is a very clear and logic movement to organics and to a very sustainable viticulture. It's not very easy all the time because we have quite an amount of rainfall in Austria. So this year, for example, it was very, very difficult because we had rain like every other day during summer, and you have to be very, very, you know, aware of what happens in the vineyard. You have to be out there every day, like the old men still do in the Spitzberg. You know, you all have to observe your vineyards. But that's the difference. But if you just spray with helicopters or whatever, you organize somebody to do the work, it's different from if you go there yourself and observe the plants. That's helpful in such a movement. But it's true, Austria is very, very driven to organics, yes.
Yes. All right, so drink Austrian wine and especially drink Müller van der Nieuport wines. They're so delicious. Dorley, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Stetson, thank you so much. Guys, look out for Blue Danube wines from Croatia, Slovenia, Hungary, Austria, Georgia.
Bosnia-Herzegovina.
And Bosnia-Herzegovina. Who knew? They're great. Stetson, thank you so much. And Week of Orange Wine, a bunch of great places to look out for, all pouring orange wine. So thanks for organizing that as well.
Thank you.
Thanks to our sponsors, Campari and Wines of Bordeaux. Thanks to David Tadashore for producing the show and the Heritage Radio Network. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.